call us to order. I have a couple of quick things. So in terms of our next hour, we're going to spend a little bit of time kind of catching up with ourselves. Then we do have representatives from Every Voice here to talk about kind of the national picture with respect to small donor incentives and public financing. That will probably take us at least up till maybe 10, maybe a little bit after that. And then we do have folks coming from Multnomah County and from the City of Portland to talk about the things that are going on with respect to public funding in their world. I did want to give a little bit of an update about our appointments and the makeup of the task forces. You know, we've had a couple of openings, and I appreciate folks who helped Laura Terrell in my office to try to track down individuals who might be interested. I am pleased to tell you that Serena Boston Ashby has agreed to serve as a representative of nonprofit organizations. She wasn't able to be with us today, but will be with us down the line. She's currently the chief operating officer for the Oregon Public Health Institute, but in her background is the African American Leadership Forum and a wide range of other nonprofit organizations. And I'm really pleased that she's going to be part of our group. We do, and I'm not sure if we have them on the phone as yet. There is a non-affiliated voter. Actually, we're looking for some geographic diversity from Eastern Oregon who is going to be listening in today. Hopefully that he will get on the phone and then have a further discussion with us about participating. His name is Rob Brascio. He is an NAV, which is an affiliated voter, which is what we were looking for, but also we really wanted to get a little Eastern Oregon perspective, rural perspective. So, are you on the phone yet, Rob? Apparently not, but he apparently has the information, so hopefully he will be joining us. So, wanted to let you know about that. As you know, we kind of came to the conclusion last time, and I reported to you around legislative leadership and their desire for the group. We had identified several issues on which we might have some discussion, and we might see whether or not greater than a 50-50 set of support could be built within the group for some reform ideas. That doesn't change anything about our first report, which will remain as it is, and maybe some of the parts of it will continue on into a second report in terms of what recommendations we have. But we took the direction of the group and did invite folks to come and talk about public financing. That was an area where some people had identified we really had not, you know, explored whatsoever. We did know there were things happening in the world in that regard and wanted to hear about them, so glad to do that. Our next meeting, we thought we would explore some of our current set of campaign finance rules. That includes reporting, that includes whatever other violations potential rules that we've set up in our system in Oregon now. Where might they be strengthened or changed? Where might penalties be either stronger or refocused in some way? What are the powers? The question has been raised, what's kind of the scope of the power of the Secretary of State's office to do enforcement of these things. Also, Department of Justice comes into play there, and what isn't. I'll come back to this at the end of the meeting, but I will go over the little short list that I have made, but I will be inviting you all to add questions or agenda items so that we make sure that we either have people to speak to them or we have the ability to have a focused discussion on things that, as you all have been looking at this overall issue and where we stand now in Oregon, what are the ideas that you want to throw out on the table for possible consideration. So that's kind of where we're going in the next time, and then in October we should start talking about are there things that we think we're going to get ready to tell the new legislature come January. So happy to open the discussion to anything that folks want to describe as having changed since the last time that we met, or that you. Hello. Do we have somebody on the phone had something? Nope. Okay. Since we met in May, Norm, thank you much, has forwarded a couple of articles that are in our meeting minutes, and I think went out even earlier than the meeting notification that sort of describes some of the analysis on the national level of if we still have Citizens United, where are the places that we can look. I noticed that's the kind of thing that we're hoping to focus on here. But do folks have other things that they want to make sure that the task force has at their attention? Kyle, yeah.
I just wanted to share a little bit of data that I thought was interesting coming out of the Republican primary. There was an article in the New York Times around the end of May. The data is from about the end of May, which is about the time that Ted Cruz finally dropped out. And it turned out that to that point, Donald Trump had spent about $60 million total from him and super PACs, which was almost nothing in his case, to get to his position as the nominee. But it turns out also that each of his three main competitors, Bush, Cruz, and Rubio.
Gene, could folks speak up?
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought I had the microphone close enough.
To hear on the phone.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Kyle's bringing the mic closer to his
way
mouth.
Closer, yeah. So as I was saying, Trump and super PACs had spent about $60 million to get his place for the nomination. But his three main opponents, Bush, Cruz, and Rubio, between them and their super PACs, had each spent about twice that much. So he was outspent 6-1 and still got the nomination. And I think this throws a little bit of water on
I'll
the...
I'll summarize.
Yeah. I think this throws a little bit of water on the notion of the power of money in politics.
It's an honor.
Okay, and I will summarize. Is the button on?
These little microphones that work on the phone, you have to use this to feed in.
Room mic.
The room mic's not on.
I think that just goes right.
Yeah.
I'm going to stick it up here by the mic.
You want to like?
if I could summarize what you said, so the folks on the phone do hear it, because I assume they do hear me. Kyle was wanting to just make the point that as they evaluate the money that was spent in the current Republican presidential primary, that in fact the ultimate winner of the primary, Mr. Trump, had spent a combination between himself and super PACs that might have been operating on his behalf about $60 million. And the three main candidates that he defeated had at least $120 million, if not more, in each of their campaigns. And Kyle is reminding us of a concern he has, which is, does the data show that the money influences the outcome of the elections as much as we draw that conclusion? Is that a fair
yep.
statement of what you're saying? Very good. Well, that folks, maybe if we're going to deal with them, we'll make sure. So those speakers there are picking up, but we don't have a speaker back there.
It does not extend that far.
So we'll maybe somebody can come up and sit in Senator Rosenbaum's seat if they want to speak, so that she'll be happy to do that so that she can hear you.
We turn okay. on the room mics.
They are.
Would that make they are on
they
for
are,
the recording?
But they're
yeah. Okay.
They're on as much as we can have things on, apparently. So
I guess. If
go ahead, Rob.
Two mm-hmm. things. One, I think it's it's not a housekeeping matter really, but there's a 2000 and I think it's a 2001 Attorney General's opinion by Hardy Myers at the time, talking about how the Oregon Constitution may limit the ability to require disclosures in campaign materials and campaign spending. And I think it might be wise to have your office request an update on that opinion. Laws have changed since then. And what we do or what we're able to do going forward may be impacted by what the AG says is the current state of the law. That's an old opinion. There's been a lot of campaign cases by the U.S. Supreme Court since that time. At the time, I think the Attorney General will had to assume what the outcomes may be interpreting certain statutes in the Constitution. As it turns out, historically, obviously, you can't bat 1,000. So I think an update of the opinion on the constitutionality of disclosures would be extremely important and useful as we go forward in determining what the scope of our ability to make recommendations is.
Thank you. I'm glad you brought that up. It was in my notes to give you a little bit of an update on a conversation. And if the people on the phone didn't hear Rob, he was repeating a question that had come up before about the Attorney General opinion on back from the 2001, 2000, whenever it was, that stated that we really could not do any regulation of disclosure, or in that case, it was the mandate of mandated disclosure, the tagline on ads, the disclaimers, and whether it would be appropriate to get a new Attorney General opinion about that. A couple of different things. We, before embarking on actually requesting an opinion, which our office would have to pay for, so and would take a little bit of time to get, we've done two things. One is for ourselves review. We just recently had an Attorney General opinion which evaluated our Oregon's current statute, which prohibits electioneering at within so many feet of a polling place, which the Attorney General had found similarly, for the similar reasons, the analysis of the Oregon Constitution, not of the federal Constitution, prohibited us from or local governments from enforcing that. It repeated the analysis that we, you know, in many respects that we have around disclosure. Aaron did have an informal consult. We didn't ask for a formalized opinion from them, but I think Ted Ruttlinger would also be available potentially to come to the committee and talk about, to ask their thought about whether, just as I say, just preliminary to investing in asking this Attorney General to look at it, the assumption of Lidge counsel, and as I say, it was a little bit of an informal thing, and we can ask him to put something on the record for us if we want, is that although under the federal law it is permissible and states are doing that, that it's the analysis of the Oregon Constitution that drove the Supreme Court's decision there, and they've been on some other issues consistent in, you know, doing that same kind of analysis. So at the moment, it's not looking as hopeful as we might have been that we could go 14 years later and ask for something new. I'm not saying never and won't do it. I guess I'd like to have further discussion, and maybe it would be helpful to have that with Ledge Counsel in the room. Norm?
That would be a very important opinion to get, because it will affect what we recommend to the legislature as a constitutional amendment. If we wanted to go forward with a current proposal together with something that would help with the taglines, we'd have to probably propose that together. And if it's necessary, we can do that. Otherwise, if the
Ledge Counsel would be the appropriate counsel for that, for supporting of legislation or making a determination of what legislature would go forward, they might have an opinion about whether it would be helpful to them to have an additional Attorney General opinion.
Well, it's a matter of whether we have to put it in the Constitution or we can do it in the statute.
Right, exactly.
Daniel, just going to ask for a point of clarification. In the discussions you had with Aaron, does it seem like the restriction on being within 100 feet of a polling location or whatever it is, does it seem like that would still not be upheld by an Oregon court? I guess I'm just confused about what exactly the
how that was relevant to the yes.
And not so much how it was relevant, but like what was the analysis 14 years later? Like, you had this conversation with the AG's office. I'm just kind of unclear about where they stand right now.
The conversation, what? Okay. requesting an official opinion from the AG's office has not happened. What I was referring to was two items have happened. One is that we have had an intervening attorney general's opinion, much more recent than the 2001, analyzing a different statute, not about disclaimers, but rather about prohibiting electioneering at polling places. Mm-hmm. The First Amendment to the Oregon Constitution analysis that this is a restriction on free speech, absolutely, and that it would not be able to be upheld under the Oregon Constitution is a very similar analysis to what you saw in 2001 on the issue of disclaimers. So that's the connection that I'm making, is that we have a more recent analysis on a different statute, so there's always some question about that, but indicating that their analysis would be, I think, giving some weight to the fact that their analysis would potentially be the same. Aaron's conversation with Ledge Counsel, different lawyers, different body. I don't know if you want to express that a little clearer than I did.
I informally asked Legislative Counsel if there had been enough substantial change in the last 14 years to merit a different conclusion before intervening with the formal opinion of the AG's office, knowing the time frame that it takes and the cost that it takes. We wanted to see and investigate and whether or not we thought a different conclusion would be reached, or if there's any reason to think a different conclusion would be reached. In an initial informal conversation with Ted Ruttlinger, he said no. He said his exact words, the answer is no, we don't believe the Attorney General or the Oregon Supreme Court would reach a different conclusion today than they did in 2001. It does not certainly prevent us from asking the question, but we wanted to see if there was initially, before we maybe made that formal investment, time frame, cost frame, all of those issues aside, if there was reason to think that a different conclusion would be reached. It doesn't in any way prohibit us. This is just an initial investigation into whether or not there would be reason to think there would be a different conclusion reached. Because one of the first things AGs do is they do contact Legislative Council, and they work together in this process. And so kind of just talking about one of the players in the formal discussion that would be part of an Attorney General's opinion would say no.
Okay.
So that's what we've done initially, putting it back in front of the task force to say, what would you like us to pursue next with this information coupled with this more recent opinion together?
Which I'm happy to get folks a copy of. I think that might be a useful step in this process.
Thank you.
Okay. In the absence of an attorney general, oh, I'm sorry, Representative Kim.
But just a comment on this topic. Mm-hmm. I know Daniel and I have been having some conversations. I think Representative Rayfield as well. And we're exploring what might be legislative possibilities. Because personally, I think disclosure of who is paying is an important election issue. And a public matter. It's my opinion. Mm-hmm. But we have perhaps constitutional constraints, and we'll have to look at that as well as legislative, and maybe legislative remedies. We're still exploring that mm-hmm. idea.
So a live discussion will continue. Rob?
You know, I guess I got a question for, maybe it's for the group or for people who remember better than I do. But the charge of the task force, is it that, is the feeling that we're going to be suggesting a list of proposed recommendation changes, or how granular are we going to get? For instance, I know quite a bit about the matching program and stuff just from historically reading documents and going through programs and stuff, but it's easy to say we think you should look at a matching program, but then do we want to say, is that the recommendation, or are we going to get more granular on this? Are we going to say how that could be implemented, where the money's going to come from? Because these are all going to be huge issues. How much do we need to know about each of these programs to make our recommendation? Because we don't have tons of time. I can't imagine we're going to be drafting legislation here. So how do we get to the recommendation stage in a timely manner for the 2017 legislature, if that's what we're thinking of? I think we're going to probably have to make some more general recommendations, probably. I get that. That makes some sense. And if so, we have to move relatively quickly, so we sort of need to know where the major players are on this. If we just don't have enough people to even look at campaign matching funds, for instance. How much time do we want to spend? Maybe we go to the next project. I'm just throwing that out there because I'd like to know sort of where the major players are on it. I'll vote for anything, pretty much. I'll lay it out right now.
I'll vote for anything.
Kyle
okay.
will vote for nothing. I respect that. I truly respect it because that's his philosophical standpoint, and he's true to his philosophy. And most people are. I'm not questioning that. But I'd like to know where the major players are so we can make quality use of our time, make quality recommendations, and then hand it off to the legislators who are eventually going to make the decision and do the hard work, honestly. Mm-hmm. But can we make some solid recommendations? How granular do we going to get? How do we get through this process in a timely manner so we don't, so the clock doesn't run out on us?
You're a good question. I think that, and others may have other things that they want to weigh in about that before I do. So go, Norman.
Well, I wanted to just further that question in that I know that the deadline for Legislative Council submissions is next month in September. And if we're going to meet that deadline of any way, we've got to pull our act together real fast. I know that you have the privilege of submitting bills to the legislature, but that still has to get through Legislative Council. And if we wait until December, then whatever we submit through you might be far down the queue for actually getting drafted in bill form. So my concern is, you know, getting something done in a timely fashion that it can be fully considered by the legislature.
Let me be clear, and Representative Rayfield has something to offer too. I have two placeholders that are already sitting at Legislative Council, and while I can't necessarily add to them, because agency deadlines are actually quicker than the legislative deadline, and so we have made every effort to have vehicles available through the Secretary of State's office. It will be the next Secretary's determination of whether those get introduced, and so you do have a lot of strange politics to go through between now and then. Maybe not strange, but at least somewhat awkward, you know. But we will have vehicles. The vehicle I had drafted before the last short session was actually a vehicle for this session because that's the only power I had. I didn't have the power to request a draft for the short session, so I borrowed against my my allotted amount, and I have another vehicle as well that can be there. We also have an elections cleanup bill that could have things added to it in that respect. My expectation is, and one of the things I was going to say at the end, but I understand people are kind of anxious about how the process is going to work, would be to ask if legislators, and we have some here who are obviously talking and thinking about it, but we also know there are legislators out in the world who are thinking about it, would be willing to come and not necessarily spill their whole bill idea and, you know, do and their you know, political situation in front of us, but at least give this group an opportunity to react to legislation that people are thinking about and talking about, and apply some of the agreed upon principles that we have in our group to help solicit that. It will be an iterative process. There's no question. I'm not as concerned this time about the having vehicles available, but I understand why you would ask that question. Representative Rayfield, did you have something? I'm sorry.
All I was going to say is that we're already working on a concept, myself and Representative Williamson, on public financing, so that, yeah, just for what it's worth. So.
And I, you know, we'll continue to request that if people could. And I think at our next meeting, Representative Rayfield's already willing to talk more, particularly more about his work on independent expenditures as well, that we will at least have the ability to react and give feedback, test the proposals that people are coming forward with against all the good thinking that you all have engaged in. But we have both the Constitution. We also.
It's Brad Martin.
Yes, Brad, go ahead.
I appreciate the question, and obviously we've got limited time, particularly in the election time frame. I guess the way I view this is we have some opportunities, but we obviously have some limitations. The opportunity is to see if there's something generally that there's broad consensus behind that we can lean into. And I think broad consensus is the key determining factor. At the same time, obviously there are limitations we have. I think it's going to be difficult for us to get granular. There are certainly esteemed legislators in the room who make this all happen, but the rest of us aren't. We're in a familiar process when we get into the legislature, but I'm hoping what we're doing is seeing if there is something we have common ground on. We may learn things that help us inform our individual views, but I do hope that today we don't get bogged down in this discussion. I understand the importance of it, but we left the last meeting saying we really wanted to hear more about public financing. We wanted to hear some of the experts in the field, one voice. And I hope we move quickly to that point, just knowing we have both their presentations and the presentations from the folks in Portland.
Thanks, Brad. Yes, go ahead, Seth.
Thanks. So back to the issue of the Attorney General opinion and a formal request. I think we should make a formal request because I don't see any relationship between a restriction of activity that was described, like the campaigning near a polling place. I actually lived above a polling place in the Hollywood Library, and I explicitly put a political poster up in my apartment, even though I knew the law existed, because I thought it was absurd. However, I see it totally different from a requirement for disclosure. Because, if that type of thing is not allowed, if a requirement for disclosure is not allowed, then we have to ban ORSTAR. So I think we should get their opinion on it so we can see if ORSTAR needs to be banned. And I think they would have to make the decision that it is consistent, that we can do it.
Again, I will commit to getting you the opinion on the electioneering bill because I think the analysis you will see has a closer relationship than might be obvious to you at this point. It may not foreclose the question. The task force itself does not have resources to pay. So again, this is something that the Secretary of State's office would have to bear. Whether we get an opinion from Ledge Council related to one of our bills and ask one of our legislators indulgence to do that, that might be another way to go about it. I think that would be pretty similar, but happy to continue to consider that, and I'll report to you shortly in the next week or so what we'll do. Try to bring that to a conclusion one way or the other. It truly is a resource issue, and it could be a few months before we get something back. That's the reality of getting a written AG opinion. Officially signed AG opinion as opposed to the kind of informal.
So AG opinions are charged to other agencies that request them?
Yes. AG time is billable time to us as agencies. Yeah, they're not freebies. Pardon?
Darn attorneys.
I know. That's right. So. Well, I do, in deference to the guests that we have, and I would like to get to and do our overview of the public financing piece. It may raise, I certainly in my mind have some questions that I'd like answered before I would jump on board to say this is something we would strongly recommend the legislature consider. So I hope you will all indulge us. And we have on the phone and Tam Doan from Every Voice Organization and Susan Motet. And she's going to come right there, yeah, and hopefully that speaker will pick her up. Okay. So let's test to make sure that when you pull the microphone to you, when you speak, that we can.
All right. Can people on the phone hear me?
Susan, I think you have to use that other microphone.
Okay.
This one. Okay. Cool. In fact, you could come right here.
Okay, sorry.
Any problem.
Okay.
Senator Rosenbaum does not mind that you take her seat.
All right. Thank you. So I'm Susan Matei from Every Voice. Every Voice
has been working on public financing of campaigns for the last 20 years, although most of that time the organization's name was Public Campaign. And largely they've been working on it through passing it on the ballot, but we have invested in working on with legislators to pass it legislatively. My colleague Tam Dewan is on the phone. She is our director of policy and research, and she has a much more detailed understanding of the different laws and the different jurisdictions. So she will be able to supplement any questions, any answers to questions. The reason Every Voice is even here in Oregon, other than the fact that I'm from Washington State and I always try to work on legislation near home, is that we've heard from people inside Oregon that there is some appetite and need for reform. We actually did consider putting a public financing measure on the ballot in Oregon in 2018, which is why we dropped a poll last fall to get a sense of where Oregonians are on money in politics and small donor-funded elections. We consulted with local people and ultimately decided there wasn't there was some tension and disagreement about how to reform campaign finance in Oregon, and we like to be deferential to where local groups and people want to go, and so we backed out and said, okay, we're not going to put anything on the ballot in 2018. And now we're back because essentially, there was some local interest that maybe small donor funded elections could be a policy that a lot of the groups that engage in campaign finance reform policies might be able to find a consensus on. And so far, there's been a lot of consensus among advocacy organizations in Oregon that we've been talking to. So we are working to, you know, lay some groundwork for legislation next year if that's where legislators end up wanting to go. So that's why we're here. But I'd like to point out, though, that while Every Voice works on small donor funded elections, we often couple it with other reforms, and we consider it very compatible with other campaign finance reforms. We do not, there is, according to us, there is no one silver bullet in campaign finance reform. So small donor funded elections works really well with other reforms. And, you know, in a world where, but there, it adds something very special that other reforms sometimes don't have. So, you know, we live in this world where the Supreme Court views spending money in politics as protected First Amendment speech, and it really opens the doors to a huge amount of unlimited, unaccountable, opaque money in the system. And a lot of reforms can bring transparency or limits, but what they don't bring, as the cost of elections keeps soaring every cycle, is an alternative to big money. So small donor funded elections provide that alternative. So while we're bringing maybe transparency and accountability to the money that is flowing into our political system, small donor funded elections provides an alternative to accepting large donations. And the reason is that while large donations do not determine races candidate by candidate, it is, you know, the people who have studied the influence of money in politics have found that it dramatically distorts the political system as a whole. So one of the questions I was asked to address today is public financing, I need a rubber band to snap on my wrist every time I say public financing, because our polling indicates when you say to voters, do you support public financing, only 16% say yes, because they don't really know what it is. But if you use other terms, for example, small donor funded elections, there's the one that tests off the chart is citizen-funded elections, but it gets into some, like, are we just helping, you know, having citizens participate versus residents? But anyway, so we try to say small donor-funded elections right now. But is small donor-funded elections an effective campaign finance reform? And, well, first I want to say that It polls extremely well. Nationally, people are very upset about the problem of money in politics. They feel like their voices aren't being heard. In our poll in Oregon last year, 69% of Oregonians wanted something to be done to reform the campaign finance system. 42% strongly supported campaign finance reform. Only 17% opposed it. So there was a 52% gap between support and oppose in Oregon. And it also, we found that this anger about campaign finance, the campaign finance system, crosses parties. Democrats are, you know, usually in the 70s or 80%. Independents, very high. Republicans, still well above 60%, you know, are frustrated about the campaign finance system. So, and we also find that there's similar support for small donor public financing as a solution. It is nationally at 72% support small donor public financing, 74% of Democrats, 76% of independents, 66% of Republicans support small donor public financing. And in Oregon, the numbers are slightly different. 57-60% of Oregonians support small donor public financing. 24-29% are undecided. So Oregon actually just has a lot more undecided people as opposed to more opponents. But the question is, so the voters, generally speaking, support it. The question becomes, does it actually work? And the first question is, what are your goals and how measurable are they? And one of our first goals at Every Voice is to empower ordinary Americans in the political system by making the donor class, which currently skews white and male and affluent, and making it look much more like the residents. And that is actually a very measurable goal. And I believe in your packets there are some charts. Yes, there are, that we had brought. A lot of them need explanation, but the one that looks like this, this is New York City, and the top one is New York City and who gave to state candidates for election. And it's the blue that are the zip codes where there were a significant number of donors. And it's a small percentage of the city. They've done the math on everyone's incomes. It's also the most affluent neighborhoods in every district that is giving in New York State. And New York State does not have any kind of small donor public financing. And then below that, the next graph is who gave in city-level elections. And New York City has a small donor public financing system where there's a 6-to-1 match for small donations. And what you see is that virtually every neighborhood is giving in the city-based elections. And it's in part because people feel like the reform makes their voice matter, and so they're happy to give their $25 as opposed to where they feel like they're just dropping it into an abyss in when there isn't a campaign finance reform like this. And it's in part because candidates, when they have an incentive, you know, a 6-to-1 match to actually go after the $25 or $50 donations, suddenly they're knocking on these doors. They're having events in these neighborhoods, and they're spending a lot less time on the phone dialing for dollars and instead raising money online or at events from more average residents. So the New York City system clearly shows that a lot more people give, and they're much more representative of the population. There's another chart here in this packet about Arizona, and this one is looking at race and income. And what they found is that before publicly financed elections in Arizona, most of the money was coming from mostly white neighborhoods that were also much more affluent. And then after publicly financed elections, more than double the amount of money was coming from lower income neighborhoods that had a much higher percentage of Latinos in Arizona. So it clearly really changed who's funding elections, and therefore who feels like their voice matters in democracy. And then the chart right below that is doing the same analysis, but just looking at income level and not just race. So what we find is that in terms of making the donor class look like the residents, a well-designed small donor publicly financed election system is very measurably successful at doing that. Other goals involve reducing the outsized influence of big donors and big money. And, you know, without a doubt, the system clearly at least reduces the role of big money in funding elections. And, you know, I mean, obviously it can still have influence in other ways. They're still going to keep hiring lobbyists. But it definitely has a big impact in the area where this handles it, which is how elections are paid for. And then one thing that's hard to measure is when you have public financing, does the policy stop being distorted toward the special interests that are the best funded? And that's really hard to measure. We have anecdotal evidence that would suggest that policies that were supported by the majority of the citizens that just never could pass, they kept getting blocked. After public financing, suddenly they did pass, and many people say it's because of public financing. But that's actually our sort of data people can't really quantify that. So for that, we just have anecdotal evidence. And then I just wanted to note there's another chart in here that shows something that I think is important to see. It's this chart with these different colored lines. And what it shows is that up to $25, donors look just like residents. A minimum wage earner will donate $25 to a candidate, especially if they think that $25 makes a difference. Above $25, it starts to skew white male affluent. But, you know, one of the things that people wonder is, well, does this really help if there are so many people who don't have the money to give? Apparently, everyone's willing to give $25. So that's one thing that our data has borne out. Then another question I was asked is it legislatively feasible to pass a small donor financed elections bill? And I will say that in one of the documents here, it shows the various places that have small donor or public finance systems. Some of these were passed on the ballot. Some of them were passed legislatively. And whether it's legislatively feasible really depends on the design of the bill. Because so many were passed on the ballot in the past, the systems were designed to please voters, not to please legislators. So they have components in them often that would make a lot of legislators nervous. But those components, for example, a really low qualifying threshold for candidates to use the system, or once you qualify by getting, you know, $505 donations, you know, giving someone, every candidate, a giant, like, $250,000 grant to run their campaign. I think one can figure out why that would make legislators nervous, because public financing at the end of the day is really about how legislators get and keep their jobs. But what we find is that the way you design a system, you can design it in a way that legislators find attractive. A lot of legislators are more frustrated than the voters about what they have to do in order to get enough money to win campaigns and keep their jobs. And there is definitely a way to design public financing bills that legislators want to pass and this is critical, want to actually run on, because there's no point in having a public financing system if no one is using it or if no winning candidates are using it. It doesn't achieve its goals. So you can design one that enables legislators to have a path to win, raise enough money to win elections, that only using small donors and some additional taxpayer dollars, that legislators actually find and candidates find a very attractive system. Let's see. And I would just also like to note that around legislative feasibility, our polling indicates that voters are much more likely to support candidates that that are proposing and acting on solutions to money in politics. And we have polling specifically on Hillary Clinton because she is a candidate who is, to a lot of voters, very tainted as having a long history of taking big money. And we wanted to see, does, if she supports, you know, small donor finance elections, which, by the way, she does, are voters going to find that hypocritical, or are they going to find that, are they going to be more likely to want to vote for her? And it turns out that voters are more likely to want to vote for a candidate because they support solutions like small donor public financing, even if that candidate has a history of taking very large donations. So then another question I was asked was, what are the different models for public financing? And there really are three primary models. The one that we work on the most is are called matching programs. So at the very basic level, a candidate does something to qualify for the program. It's usually collecting a certain number of small donations. And once they're certified as qualifying, they then agree not to take any donations above a certain amount, say $250, and in exchange for that agreement, any donations up to a certain amount, say $50, $75, wherever it's set, are then matched. Strong systems match them pretty highly, like 6-1, because typically that's what it takes to make up for not taking the larger donations. And at Every Voice, we create a model where we look at all of the campaign donations to every candidate in every race, how many donors each candidate has, and how much money it costs to win the most competitive races. And then we feed all that into a spreadsheet that Tam, my colleague, creates to show, you know, how much do you have to match, how much dollars in public financing to get everyone who, given the reasonable donor base that we've looked at for, you know, we're not just saying we think it's reasonable to have 1,000 people. We're actually saying, well, currently, you know, candidates for the legislature tend to have this many. You know, donors are a little more generous when they think their dollars are matched. So, you know, we can have them stretch a little bit. But does that donor base with that matching rate actually get enough money to reasonably win races in Oregon? That's the model we work on, and so that's how we create what the matching rate is, up to what, how much money you can accept. That's how we kind of create those recommendations so that it works specifically for this jurisdiction. You can't copy another jurisdiction system. It may not work at all the same way. But that's what small donor, that's what the matching system looks like. A different program is a voucher system, which Seattle just passed last November. And in many ways, it's similar to the matching system. You qualify by, you know, getting a certain number of donations of a certain amount. You agree not to take donations over a certain amount. But the difference is that in Seattle, every eligible resident will receive 4 $25 democracy vouchers that they can send to their campaign, the campaigns of choice. And so the theory is, it hasn't been implemented, it's implemented next year, but the theory is that this really evens the playing field. Now you're a minimum wage earner, you know, candidates know they have $100 of vouchers, just like someone in a more affluent neighborhood. So the hope is that it kind of has the same outcome as small donor public financing, but the hope is that it levels the playing field about who has the money to give. The third system is a grant system. In many ways, it's kind of old-fashioned, although it does work very well in Connecticut. And they passed it legislatively, but they kind of got tricked into it. They were trying to put a grant system on the statewide races, but not on the legislature. And then the governor said, I'll only support it if you guys apply it to yourselves. So they applied the grants to their own races, and 84% of winning candidates in Connecticut use the public financing system. And basically, it's the same thing. You collect a certain number of donations to qualify, and then in Connecticut, they just give you like $250,000 to run your campaign. So every candidate has about the same amount of money to run their campaign. They do give if you're a candidate under a party that doesn't get a certain percentage of the vote, like 5% of the vote or 15% of the vote, you get a much smaller grant. but that's how Connecticut's works. So there are kind of pros and cons for each of the systems. The biggest ones would be with vouchers. They have not been implemented yet. There is no data on how successfully they do even the playing field between voters and donors. And there is fear that candidates are going to, well, do what they should do, right? They're going to trying to win. They're going to try and collect as many vouchers as cheaply and quickly and efficiently as possible. Is going to be faster and cheaper to go to affluent, like A, people already on their list, donor list, and B, the more affluent, white, high engagement voters in the city. So there's some fear that at least in the first cycle, it may not have achieved its goal of really bringing lower engagement voters into the donor system. We are going to be studying that at Every Voice and working with local partners to do outreach and see what types of outreach work so that in future cycles, we have much better odds that the program does achieve its goals. But that is sort of the big scary thing about vouchers. And then I guess the big sort of maybe kind of frightening thing about grants is that because it's sort of a big lump sum, voters can sometimes view it more like welfare for politicians. And there's some concern that maybe some money is being wasted because it might even the playing field between candidates too much. A serious candidate versus a candidate that hasn't, all they've done is cleared the bar to qualify, but they haven't really done a lot of outreach, you know, and building up their support network. Some people think it might be a little bit wasteful to give it to candidates that aren't that serious. So that's the con for that. So that would be the main different types of public financing. And another question I was asked to address is, what are some examples of successfully implemented policies? And we use a couple of examples. New York City, they have the 6-to-1 match. They have, the council has really changed, or elected officials have really changed. They themselves look a lot more like their constituents. More women on the council, more people of color on the council, and more people who don't have access to networks of wealth to fund campaigns. So in that regard, it's definitely been very successful. However, New York City system has such a high limit for what you can accept. I mean, it's, Tam might know off the top of her head, I think it's like at least a couple of $1,000s, that while it does change what the council, what elected officials look like, it hasn't reduced the influence of big money in politics. So it's successful at meeting some goals and not at other goals. Connecticut, because 84% of candidates use the system, and it is a grant system, so there's really just no money flowing into politics beyond taxpayer dollars. It's for sure you've reduced the influence of big money in politics. So that's another example of a really successful system. And then another thing I was asked was, what conditions exist for a program to be implemented successfully? And what we find is the first thing is making sure that the system is designed really well tailored to your existing political environment. It provides enough money to win, not so much that it's wasteful. It's, you know, and it's designed in a way that amplifies small donors over large donors. So it's really, you know, spreading, it's really making the politicians accountable to the people. But I would also say that flexibility of design is critical. And there are a lot of public financing systems on this list that are either not used or that they're used but they don't actually achieve any goals. And it's often because they were passed in 1974 or 1989 or 1996, and there was no mechanism to change the amount of money they provided. Or it was tied to inflation, which has not increased at the rate that how much money it takes to win campaigns has increased. So what we usually recommend is that the bill says, you know, this rate can, you know, this, like, the governor's race can, you know, the public cap, match cap is, you know, $3 million. This cycle and then next cycle, a formula is used to determine where that cap is set so that as, you know, the what it costs to win elections changes, hopefully goes down, but could continue to go up. The system is, all the numbers are adjusting to the exact system so that the bill doesn't basically become outdated at any point. But then the third piece that makes things implemented successfully is having people and groups on the ground organizing around the system, encouraging candidates to use the system, helping, encouraging donors to donate to candidates so that people who use the system and who reflect the values of the voters can easily get enough contributions to qualify and to raise enough money to win. If you don't have that happening on the ground, candidates are less likely to use the system, fewer candidates win on the system. It's a lot easier to defund the system, repeal the system, because there's just no one out there really protecting it. So those would be the three characteristics that make a system successful. I had mentioned before the Oregon-specific model, we can share aspects of it later. We're reluctant to share the entire model because it takes all of the campaign contribution data and puts it in really digestible form, and we're afraid that that might give, just giving that information away might actually be considered a contribution, a gift. So we have to figure that out. But we're happy to use the model and show people the model. And I have a sort of front page of the model, and we looked at what it would cost to design an appropriate matching system in Oregon for every statewide race, legislative race, and the court, Supreme Court, Appellate Court, Circuit Court, and district attorneys, because we were asked about what that judicial public financing would look like. And we did find that with this design that we, our first sort of first blurt, it would cost about $26 million a year, depending on which races you include and the exact details of the program. The cost could go down dramatically or go up dramatically. It's something that we can kind of help people manage and design. But that is 0.08% of the Oregon budget. We like to call it budget dust. Often people who are more conservative find public financing attractive because it costs so little and can save money in the budget by kind of cutting away any movement toward crony capitalism, where someone gets an overly generous contract because they gave money to an elected official. To the extent that there is waste in the budget based on that, public financing can more than pay for itself by eliminating that sort of thing. Let's see.
We do want to have a few minutes for questions,
yes.
And we have other guests here.
Sure,
so,
please.
The last thing
I had was what would be the benefits in Oregon, and it's really just achieving the goals I had laid out before. And then another question was what might be some negative effects, the design can take into account you know, when you cut big money out of a system, the question is, where does the big money go? And one thing you can do is you can create little outlets inside of the system for that money to express itself, but not, you know, have too much influence. But then there also is the question of, does a bunch of money end up going into independent expenditures? And that is where coupling it with other types of reforms can actually prevent that money from just shifting into independent expenditures alone.
If I could just really quickly thank everybody for being willing to come. One of the challenges that we kind of faced in our last go-around before the last session is that there, and will always be the challenge, I think, of a public task force, is that political organizing that people are doing out around us isn't always, people don't necessarily feel safe to bring it to a public table where everyone will hear. And clearly every voice is an impassioned advocate of this and willing to share the ways they are looking at it and what they are trying to do as they talk to various Oregonians, legislators, and others. And I do appreciate that fact, because I think it helps inform your sense of likelihood of various things. I am wondering, and are you available to stay with us throughout the morning a little bit more?
Yes.
I was wondering, because we do have folks from other places, if we wanted to take about a 6-minute break and then come back and have folks from Portland and Multnomah County talk, and then we can come back to questions. I'm sure you have some. Are there any that are urgent this moment? I heard a little something on the phone. Is that so? Let's be in recess for about 6 minutes, and then we'll ask our guests, other guests, to come forward, and we'll keep this conversation going. Thank you. Just to add to our store of what's being discussed and what's out in the world of Oregon with respect to this, we have Jack.
I love it when I get promoted.
That's right. Jackie Weber from Multnomah County, who is going to talk with us about our campaign finance charter, or their campaign finance charter amendment. I know that Dan Meek, who we all know is a member of the Charter Commission and was going to be on the phone. I don't know. He could signal if he's going to be. He may have something he wants to add. But since there is an active discussion on Multnomah County, we're grateful you're willing to come and give us an update on that.
Sure. And just to clarify, Mr. Meek was not a member of the commission.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He was not. He was a frequent attendee.
A stakeholder.
Stakeholder, yeah.
Very good. Thank you.
So just a little background, because not every county or city's charter is
okay,
the same.
Okay, would you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I speaking loud enough? My name's Jacqueline Weber. WEBER, and I'm the Deputy County Attorney for Multnomah County. And I staffed the 2016 Charter Review Committee. Multnomah County Charter requires a Charter Review Committee to be convened every 6 years, and the Charter Review Committee is selected by the senators and legislators from the districts within the county, and it is convened, and our office staffs the committee. We provide any legal advice that they request, and we make sure that the process goes along as it's supposed to go along. We do not in any way influence the issues that the committee chooses to study in any way. That's not our role. So with this particular Charter Review Committee, the 2016 one, chose to study the issue of campaign finance reform. And there was a subcommittee that was formed around that. And that subcommittee came back to the full committee with a recommendation regarding campaign finance reform that would go into the county charter if the voters choose to pass it. Another issue that you need to understand about the Charter Review Committee in Multnomah County is that the Board of County Commissioners does not have any discretion whether or not to forward to the voters the matters that the Charter Review Committee has decided to pass. So in this case, there were five measures that the Charter Review Committee decided to pass. That the they have to be passed on to the Elections Division by a vote of the commissioners, but the Board of County Commissioners has no discretion whether or not to pass it on. They must pass it on according to our charter. Okay, so that was something of an issue for some of our commissioners. So.
I'm shocked.
Just want to let you know that. So, I think you all received a copy of the proposed charter language, and I can summarize it for you. It limits contributions to candidates for political office. It applies only to the elected officials for Multnomah County, not all political subdivisions within the county are affected. In other words, only the Board of County Commissioners, the sheriff, and the auditor for Multnomah County. So it limits contributions to those candidates for political office. An individual or an entity may make contributions only as specifically allowed to be received within the measure. And it limits the amount that a candidate for political office may receive. And it limits expenditures of a candidate for political office. So that's sort of the broad brush of what it does. We did identify that there are probably some constitutional issues with the measure. and the committee, and I'm not, all committee meetings are public meetings and they are recorded, so I'm not telling tales out of school by telling you this, but the proponents of this measure on the committee were well aware of that. The whole committee was made aware of it, obviously, and it was the consensus of a majority of the committee that despite those constitutional issues, Multnomah County should move forward and see if we couldn't forge ahead despite those obstacles and maybe change some law along the way. So, do you want me to go through? I don't really know what you want from me about this. I mean, I'm happy to keep talking. I'm happy to answer questions.
If I could jump in with a question then, is that okay?
Go ahead, Kyle.
I think the most important term that was not defined by the charter was true original sources. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me what that means?
I cannot. I did not write this. The committee was made aware that there were undefined terms and other issues with the measure that they were putting forth. But since I was not involved in its creation, I can't help you with that. That's one of the challenges we will have if it passes. Yes?
A couple of things, I guess. One is I was intrigued. Any employer who makes deductions in their salary to the employee, mm-hmm. for the employee. So I guess that would include health insurance or virtually anything would be mandatorily required to do this under this provision, page 24.
Yes, that would appear to be the case.
Okay.
A simple reading, yes.
And I guess the other thing is I was intrigued as I read this report. On page 7 in the committee conclusions, it would seem to me it was remarkably biased in that it talks about the big money folks, and it says in point 2, without limits on the size of campaign contributions and independent expenditures, the wealthy and corporations have undue power to influence election and politics. And I just would like to point out, I think the unions are big money players too. And I was surprised to see that fairness missing.
Multnomah County?
I was surprised to see it in an official report, if I mean, responding to the Multnomah County Commission.
Was there a provision where unions were excluded?
Could have been included.
I did not find it in my reading of it, but it's just interesting in their committee conclusions. They identify major contributors as the wealthy and corporations, but frankly, in most of the elections I'm familiar with, that would also include the unions. That's the more typical threesome that I see, and I just found it unusual, if not of considerable concern, that a major money player was not acknowledged.
Unions are also corporations.
That's correct.
That's not backward.
There are several not to be. In compliance with the law, I've chosen not to be. They are perfectly legal, but they just aren't any of that, so they...
Okay, well, that's news to me. Thank you.
There's a loophole.
Yeah,
it's a loophole. I do have a...
Representative Kenner's point, I think, is well taken in terms of commenting on the committee's introductory material, but let's clarify that as independent expenditure donors or as donors generally, union organizations are not necessarily protected here and able to make contributions that business corporations are not able to. Would that be a fair statement?
That's probably so a fair statement.
Granted, the introductory language might not address that, but it seems to be in regard.
Good question.
I'm connected on number two when there's a chance for people on the phone.
Sure. Go ahead, Senator.
So thank you for this presentation. It looks like this is not a voluntary system. Is that true?
That the proposal is not a voluntary system?
Right. Yes. That's my question.
Correct. Yes.
And then it's a very detailed schematic that's laid out in here. Was it modeled on any existing system in another jurisdiction?
I actually can't answer that. I believe that the proposal was brought to the members of the committee by Dan Meek, and I was not at all involved in the drafting of it. So I do not know what, if anything, it was modeled on.
I do think it reflects, and I'm not speaking to personal knowledge of how it was developed, but more it reflects a good many of the concepts that over the years have been sort of tried and tested and discussed in this group and others in terms of what are the pieces that have to be covered in order to move it forward. So I'm sure it was built on sense of what might have the possibility of at least in part being found to be constitutional or has not yet been found unconstitutional, in addition to designing a system the way advocates might. Is Dan on the phone by any chance? I know it was his hope to join because he could speak to that. But
could I have county councilor just outline?
Sure.
You said it sets limits. Could you just basically outline the structure of it? What are the donation expenditure limits, generally speaking, and are they attached to inflation, since there's members of the public obviously interested too?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say I didn't actually bring a copy of it with me, so I have to look at it.
So you don't remember?
Maybe we just read the summary?
Yeah.
Out loud,
yeah.
Maybe?
It's right there. She has it.
So
I think...
Just for the record.
Yeah. Okay, so what it does is it limits contributions, expenditures, and requires disclosure in Multnomah County candidate elections. It would be a charter amendment. And the summary of it is that it limits contributions, expenditures to support or oppose a candidate for Multnomah County elected offices. The limitations on contributions received by a candidate committee per election cycle is from any individual $500 and from any political committee also $500. It allows for the formation of small donor committees. I believe is defined. Some things, terms used are not defined. I believe that one is defined. And a small donor committee is limited to receiving no more than $100 per individual, per person, per year. However, it does not limit the contributions that a small donor committee may make to a candidate. It requires that an entity that spends more than $750 per election cycle on independent expenditures has to register as a political committee and has to report out the sources of its funding. It also limits independent expenditures in any county candidate race to $5,000 per individual and $10,000 per any political committee. But only from contributions by individuals of $500 or less per year. It's rather a complicated system. It requires each communication to voters related to the county candidate elections to prominently disclose their five largest true original sources of funding in excess of $500 for each communication that they make to the public. And it provides for civil fines for violations. Sufficient?
Okay. I have a question to you, Madam Secretary.
Yes.
Just to clarify, the independent expenditures and so on, that's already reportable. So in a nutshell, these county positions have affected now, if they form a political committee and they receive X amount of dollars under state law, this the information they're talking about here would be then, you wouldn't have to, but it would be publicly available online. It doesn't change any of your existing reporting requirements.
I don't think so. We've not done a line-by-line analysis and gone over it with counsel, so I can't say for sure. But it does not seem to touch on our own, our reporting obligations in that regard.
Well, I was only raising it because the way they're going to find violations is looking at North Star. That's my point.
I see. Well, my apologies if we in our effort to make sure that we had in front of us the kinds of political proposals that are out and will be out, and if I understand counsel correctly, this will go before voters. There's not an intervening step that has to happen before that happens. The charter, the other issues involving the charter are voted on separately. So each of these are voted separately, or are they a package?
No, each individual charter section where amendments or new charter sections are proposed is a separate ballot title.
Okay. So we will have this on the ballot in Portland, and that will and it does not include a public financing component, so sorry, we kind of squeezed this into primarily a discussion about that, but it does cover contributions, expenditure limits, and independent expenditure limits all together, and some of the disclosure things that would have been potentially implementations of our, you know, what we were seeking to let the Constitution allow us to do. But this will test it in its in the beginning. Thank you, Representative. Yes.
Madam Chair, you said it applies to Portland. I believe this applies to the entire Multnomah County.
Multnomah County.
It actually will not apply to
City of Portland.
To City of Portland elections.
Yes. So
only to
backwards.
Multnomah County, countywide elections. And only to the countywide.
I see the
countywide,
city of Portland that is in Multnomah County. Right.
But it doesn't apply to their elections, no.
No, it only applies to those that
the are elected
the county officials that are
county
being elected.
County elected officials, that. Yeah.
So city, none of the cities within their people, and certainly not legislators within Multnomah County, the Multnomah County offices only.
So my question is, does Multnomah County have the resources to change, defend the constitutionality of the expenditure limits that are in here, both for candidates and independent expenditures? That case could go all the way to the United States Supreme Court.
We have a very robust office, and we are more than capable of dealing with whatever we are required to deal with in that regard. Yes.
Say nothing of the Oregon Constitution, of course. And I want to make the point that even if these provisions are struck down, they'll still be in the charter in such a way that if the either the Oregon Constitution or the United States Constitution were changed, then they would go into effect.
Correct. Any litigation around them would not remove it from the charter. That would have to be by an election of the people, but it could be made an ineffective provision of the charter depending on the outcome of litigation, if there is some. Yes.
I think Norman is taking it to the next step, which is if the state constitution or the federal constitution were amended such as to make it constitutional,
it would still be there
and potentially enforceable.
Just like Measure 47 is still sitting on the
list. Yes, right.
Exactly like that.
Nikki.
Could you tell us how the members were selected and then how the vote was? I know that there was a vote to put it on the November ballot.
So the members of the committee are chosen by their state representatives in their district. Senators, I believe, depending on the number of senators and legislators per district within the county dictates the number of individuals they get to appoint. So that's how they're appointed. And they tend to be people who are otherwise, you know, somewhat politically active in their districts so that, you know, the elected officials at the state level know of them. And so that's how they're chosen. And we simply convene them and work with them and assist them through the process. Does that answer your question?
It looks like there are 13 members, and I think Nikki was also asking, was the vote?
Oh, the vote. The vote was it was a majority, but it was not a. There were members of the committee who did not vote in favor of it. Yes, I can't recall exactly. The numbers of the vote.
I believe the vote was 7-6.
Okay. Just like us.
Yeah.
Only we have Republicans in this room.
I don't know the registration of all these 13 people, nor do you, Senator.
So, Madam Secretary, I do know the registration of all the senators members and representatives in Multnomah County.
It's not impossible that one of them may have felt obliged to make
their bipartisan. Some of them would, in fact, do that to show fairness, Madam.
Yes,
there were some non-Democrats.
Well,
non-Democrats.
All right. Well, very good. I appreciate it, and I appreciate the kind of awkward position that you're in with respect to this in terms of advocating for it. I think we have heard a lot of the discussion around these kinds of provisions, again, in our own discussion, and it will be very useful, I'm sure, to the public debate to see how the voters in Multnomah County react to this charter.
Interesting.
Thank you very much for taking the time to come.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. So we now are going to hear from the City of Portland. Tim Crail's Chief of Staff for Commissioner Amanda Fritz and Christina Nieves, Policy Advisor for the Commissioner. Thank you for being here.
Jay Atkins, members of the task force. As you said, my name is Tim Crail. I'm Chief of Staff to Portland City Commissioner Amanda Fritz.
I'm Christina Nieves, Policy Advisor with Commissioner Amanda Fritz's office.
I think I can safely say that Commissioner Amanda Fritz is the only elected official in the state of Oregon who was elected using public campaign financing. She was elected in 2008 using what was then called voter-owned elections. It was a grant system that required candidates to gather 1,000 contributions of $5 each, no more, no less. And when after receiving that $5,000 in support from Portlanders, they received $145,000 of city funds to run a campaign in a primary limited to $150,000. In the 2006 election, Amanda Fritz was a candidate against an incumbent, used the system, and was unsuccessful. Also in 2006, there was a candidate for the other council seat that was up who abused the system, committed fraud. Her name was Emily Boyles, and she both used the money fraudulently and gathered the signatures and the funds fraudulently. That was found out, and there were there was a conviction, and there's still money being collected to this day in trying to return those funds to the city. Because of that 2006 election, there were many changes made by the campaign commission between the 2006 and 2008 elections to correct the problems that existed in 2006. A system was put in place where every contribution had to be received and noted and signed by the donor that was their funds and that they were donating it to that candidate. There was also a lot of measures put in place for proper use of the funds. Emily Boyles had hired her daughter at a very inflated rate to do the work on her campaign. And so one of the provisions, for example, was that you could not hire a family member using the public funds on your campaign. There were many others as well. In 2008, she was elected using this system, and in that election, it was an open seat. There were six candidates in the race. Five of them chose to use the system. Of those five, of those six, two of the candidates who used the system made it through to the general election. In the general election, they were each given an additional $200,000 to run their general election campaign. Commissioner Fritz was elected in 2008. In 2010, voter-owned elections was put in front of the voters for approval. It had been part of the agreement in 2005 when it was put in place that it would be put in front of the voters after three cycles. Because of Emily Boyles and because we were at the height of the recession, things were quite bad in 2010. Voters narrowly rejected continuation of the system. It, out of 200,000 votes, it failed by about 2,000. Commissioner Fritz was reelected in 2012 using mostly her own personal family funds. She ran against a very well-funded opponent, who many of you probably know. I won't name names. And she was reelected. And when she was reelected, she said, one of my goals is to bring back public campaign financing. We looked at doing it shortly after that, but there was not the community support to take it on so close to after the voters had rejected voter-owned elections in 2010. This year, Mayor Charlie Hales declared he was not going to run for reelection. And when he declared that, he also said, we need to change how we fund systems in the city of Portland. And his support for doing a public campaign finance system was enough of a impetus to get us working again on it this year. And so now Christina will run through what we are proposing to put in place.
Thank you. I want to make sure that everybody has this outline here. I know that I have copies as well. Okay, thank you.
To the other chair so that the people on the phone can hear you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Maureen.
With some of the goals that we kept in mind as we're trying to, you know, find solutions to this clear imbalance. We hear a lot of talk nationally, this clear imbalance with elections that, you know, big money can sometimes dictate the outcomes or set the agenda during elections. So I'm going to go through some of the goals. Number one, we want to remove the perceived or real influence of big money. We have a lot of perception in Portland. You know, we see some big donations go to some candidates. And what that does for average donors is really pose the question, okay, what does that big donation pay for? So even if there isn't a real influence of big money, it's the perception that really hurts the public's trust in the system. We want to amplify the voices of small dollar contributors, make sure that average people who can only give a small amount of money still feel like candidates will listen to them, still engage with them. We want to increase transparency and accountability. You ask average voters how they feel about the system, you'll probably get general answers of disenchantment. People do believe that the system is broken. That's something that we can pretty much all agree on. The system needs some reforms. So through our proposal, what we'd like to do is create new reforms to increase transparency and also hold those who are running accountable. We also want to allow candidates from diverse backgrounds the opportunity to run. We have lots of changing demographics. In Portland, there have only been 2 people of color and 7 women to ever serve on city council. So we want to make sure that those who are given the opportunity to run really reflect the community that they are going to potentially serve and understand the issues that they all face. And we also want to make sure that candidates can be competitive and run a campaign by engaging a broader pool of small donors. Candidates and campaigns, they react and they respond to the system that's set before them. You do need a lot of money, a substantial amount of money, to get your message out and have a successful campaign. So we'd like to do through our proposal is, as much as we can, shift the focus a little bit back to the broader public. And, you know, fundraising is still important, but we still want candidates to engage with more people. We want to make sure that we're utilizing our public dollars responsibly, making sure that, as you know, Tim said, people will abuse the system if they're able. And so we want to make sure that we're putting enough safeguards to protect the system from abuse and fraud. And we also want to assist in making the cost of campaigns affordable and accessible. There could be many viable candidates out there who have ties to the community, they have history in Portland, they're ready to serve, and they are immediately selected out of running because of the high cost of running a campaign. And so we want to make sure that that isn't the only barrier, that somebody doesn't run for office. They have to be viable. They're serious candidates. But just because they don't have half a quarter of $1 million shouldn't be the only reason that they don't run for office. So I'm going to go through the next section. How does actually somebody use the system? How does the system in Portland work? Right now, I believe you can pay a $30 or $50 application fee if you want to run for commissioner seat or mayor seat. In our system, we'd like candidates, participating candidates, to file for office by petition. Again, focusing away on the money and really focusing on how much community support do you have, how many people you've been talking to, how many people support you. You need to be certified as a public finance candidate and establish a campaign account. Obviously, we need these things for tracking. And then only accept donations under the cap. So probably didn't say this before, but we are adopting a matching system, a public matching system that is similar to New York's. So under that system, our donations would be capped at $250. Participating candidates will not be able to accept a donation that's over that amount. And if they're running for commissioner seats, there's some thresholds they need to meet first before receiving public funds. They need to collect at least $2,500 from at least 250 individuals. And if they're running for mayor seat before collecting public funds, they need to get at least $5,000 from a total of 500 individuals. And just to make it really clear, all of these contributions must come from individuals. They can't come from a union, they can't come from a PAC. We're making it really clean, really clear. These contributions need to come from individuals. So we also have some spending caps in our proposal. We want to make sure that we're being responsible with our public funds. There are a lot of needs in the city, and of course democracy is always a priority, but we want to make sure that we're being responsible with these dollars, and we also want to make sure that we're checking the rising cost of campaigns. So we have some spending caps. Participating candidates for commissioner seat cannot spend more than a total of $550,000 over the entire election cycle. $250,000 can be spent in primary, and then the remaining $300,000, if necessary, can be spent in the general. Mayor seat, the cap is set at $950,000, $380,000 in the primary, and then $570,000 can be spent in the general. And we reached these numbers through doing some modeling from our national partners and really working in the parameters with, you know, what does it take? What would it take for someone to be successful and still engage the broader public? And also, how much money can we really dedicate to this program? Some other major components of the program, we're going to be increasing our penalties for those who intentionally misappropriate funds. We understand this is a new system, so a mistake that was unintentional, of course, will not receive a high penalty. But if there is an intentional abuse, they'll need to respond to, I think, up to $10,000 for a fine. We'll also be increasing the penalties for those that break the rules that are already on the books. We will be clarifying the definitions around independent expenditure coordination. So right now, that definition of independent expenditure coordination is pretty vague. What we'd like to do is tighten that definition, make it really clear when someone's coordinating and when someone's acting independently. We also will not allow our participating candidates, those that opt into the program — it is a voluntary program — those that opt into the program may not self-fund their campaigns. They must use the system appropriately, engage with many small donors, many individuals, rather than talking to a few wealthy individuals or simply self-funding their campaign. There will be strict regulations on the allowed uses of public funds. So those who opt into the system and they collect their matching dollars, they'll have strict limits on what they can use those public dollars on. No wining and dining, no lavish travel expenses. There will also be, we hope to increase the reporting requirements for all candidates participating and non-participating. We hope to have increased reporting requirements in order to more quickly be able to verify what is being reported and what actually happened. And then on the back, just going to go into the details of our matching program, the matching program that we've set up. Currently, we have the cap, as I said, set at 250. We have an option of 6-to-1 match. A 6-to-1 match, I think, was mentioned earlier, for donations up to $50. So you could give or receive a $250 donation in the system, and up to 50 of that would be matched 6-to-1. So really trying to focus the value on the smaller donations, really helping those candidates have the opportunity to engage with many individuals rather than just a few individuals to fund an entire campaign. So in our system, a $50 donation would become $350. So the 300 represents the 6-to-1 match, and then the 50 is the original private donation. We will be capping in-kinds at $20,000, and we will be completely exempting in-kinds that have to deal with civic participation. So volunteer in-kinds, canvassing, and phone banking in-kinds, those that really get people together, get to know the candidates, get to know the issues, we value that. We want to see that renewed interest in participating in the system. So we will not count those towards the in-kind cap. We will allow candidates to start with $5,000 of seed money. This seed money can come from anywhere. It can come from a union. It can come from the candidate themselves. And it's not available for public match, but we realize that $5,000 of seed money, startup money essentially, is really necessary to, you know, establish a website, get a campaign manager. So we are allowing that $5,000 of seed money. And finally, providing oversight to this entire program will be an independent commission. This commission will be able to change things necessary as different factors in our city change, be able to update the program and make sure that it's flexible and can continue to work. And they will also be making recommendations. If there does seem to be an issue of fraud, they will find that issue and then fix it so it doesn't happen again. They'll be assessing audit reports and making recommendations to council on how we can achieve best practice. And they will also be assessing lessons learned from other jurisdictions that have adopted similar programs, and really serve as a way for the community to see, you know, how the system works and how we can make it something that the city of Portland can be proud of, and standing in the forefront of increasing our democracy. Go ahead.
So the in-kind thing, I'm wondering if in-kinds would be allowed to do any part of either portion of the fundraising, for example, the initial $2,500 or the matching portion, because if someone else can just, some big organization can in-kind that entire process, they can effectively end up funding the entire campaign through the small donor program without any volunteers whatsoever.
We haven't considered that question before, so it's a good question to think about. We would certainly want to encourage in-kind donations that further house parties, other ways for candidates to connect with potential donors. So
just the increase of civic participation, I'm just wondering if canvassing includes fundraising. That's just on.
Yeah, the $20,000 we did not intend to restrict anything beyond what is provided for in state law and what an in-kind contribution is. The exemption is just saying you can go above that if it's for these specific purposes, but the $20,000 in-kind is anything allowed by state law.
If Before we get to other questions, could I ask really quickly where you are in the process? Because you're obviously, you have evaluated, kind of set out your principles and the basic structure. Now what happens?
Yeah, we're currently drafting the code language in a city attorney's office. We have had community meetings. We had one just on Monday night. We hope to have another public meeting in early September and bring it to council sometime in November. For various reasons. But we want to do this while the current mayor is in office because he is a supporter of making these changes. So our intention is to do something before the end of the calendar year.
And it isn't at this point set out as something that would go to the voters.
We're hoping to just pass it at council.
To pass it at council. Gotcha. And I'm wondering, as we get into questions, perhaps we could have Susan join up here, just because there might be questions that relate to her as well. And I cut off questions at that time. So, Representative Kenner, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under major components of the program, increased reporting requirements for all candidates. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think we're hoping to do around 7-day reporting for candidates. Obviously, we hope to have staff on the commission that will provide guidance to new candidates or campaigns, or really just anyone that, that needs assistance with that. But the increased reporting requirements really came from the community as a concern to make sure that we are being accountable and transparent.
It's actually something raised by our city attorney just when we met with her this week about whether we can do that. And so we will be talking to the Secretary of State's office. We will be connecting with the Secretary of State's office very soon to ask that question of whether we are entirely preempted or if we can require additional reporting in our system, and both for participating candidates and non-participating candidates.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for the last point.
Kyle.
I find that the system you described would discriminate against candidates like me, who, due to personal circumstances, for example, I have a newborn child at home, and my party doesn't give me any organizational support, I can't go out into the community and gather signatures or small donations. I just don't have time to do it. And other difficult personal circumstances might include things like being elderly or having severe allergies that would keep you from being outside very much. None of those circumstances would affect of candidates' ability to serve in the office, but would seem to effectively disqualify them from the public financing. Does this concern you, and what would you do about it?
Do the contributions have to be made in person, or can they be gathered online as long as online includes an affidavit certifying it's from the person it says it's from?
Yeah, I do believe as we get the appropriate tools that we need for verification that, yes, we're in a new age, and I think online donations would be completely appropriate in the system.
I think he's talking about the petition.
Oh, are you talking about the petition?
Kyle? Both, yes, so the petition too.
Yeah, but isn't the contribution? So couldn't that be done online and not in person?
I mean, we could certainly look into that.
Okay.
Yeah, I think one thing I would just say is the system is a voluntary system, and I don't know of a system we could put in place that would address all of your concerns. If you have suggestions on that, we'd be happy to listen. But at some point, running for office does involve engaging with the community.
I think what he's talking about is, folks, you have to file for office by petition, which means you are physically using your body or volunteers. It would be one alternative. And so you might have an alternative for folks that, you know, are physically unable to do that, or and may not have the volunteer resources, or quite frankly have family circumstances that prevent them from doing that. And I think that clearly getting donations is something where you sit on the phone and you dial, right? And I don't think you would want to discriminate somebody, you know, with folks that may not have that ability to actually gather petitions. So,
yeah, I mean, certainly you would be able to use volunteers, family members, whoever, to help gather the 100 signatures.
Yeah.
And it's only 100 signatures in the city of Portland to get onto the ballot. So it's not that onerous of a task to get the 100 signatures, I don't believe. It is a citywide race of over 500,000 people that live in the city of Portland. So part of the system is to make sure that there is some viability of a candidate to run a citywide campaign to gather the minimum required to start receiving city funds, public funds, before kicking off the campaign. So there is a certain totally requirement of viability.
Totally grasp that. You might look at alternative ways not to impact folks that may not have the ability to do that.
Commissioner Dave?
Yeah, I guess this is always a challenge in how to use public financing to increase the diversity in your sort of in the candidates who are running, and particularly providing opportunities.
Can you pull your speaker a little closer to you, Dave? That one there. Yeah. Thank you.
And particularly encouraging people to run from, say, otherwise marginalized communities that don't have that opportunity. The challenge is, I think, and this is where how to achieve this balance, is you also want to put into place fairly rigorous reporting requirements, which does add to the burden of running. And therefore, someone who might otherwise be encouraged to run because they have access to public financing may go, but wait, here are all the reporting requirements I'm going to be spending, or I'm going to have someone tracking everything I'm doing, all the money that's coming in, clearly keeping track of in-kind contributions, things like that. And I don't think there's a great solution to that, but is that something you've looked at? So you again, put in place fairly rigorous reporting requirements without crossing over the line into what you could call onerous reporting.
Good point. I'm sure that's something I'll think about.
Yeah, it's a balancing act for us, because we are talking about public dollars here, and we're trying to make sure that we're using those dollars responsibly, and that the candidates are receiving them only if they are achieving a certain level of legitimacy through signature verification. The differences between the 2006 and 2008 system was, in 2006, any resident of Portland could give the $5, and there was no signature verification that ensured that they were indeed Portlanders. In 2008, with the individual triplicate form that was required, every signature was checked by the county elections division to verify they were a city of Portland resident. And we would prefer not to have it be required that you're a registered voter, but because of the signature verification, that was what was put in place in 2008, and we're proposing the same provision. So I get the onerous reporting, but we also want to make sure that we're really transparent because of the public funds that are involved.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions, issues? Can I ask a little bit of an elephant in the room question? Not that this group will necessarily spend a lot of time thinking about budgets for such things. We have our legislators to do that. But what are you assuming ballpark at the moment, reinstitution of a different program than you had before would cost the city?
Under the previous system, it was limited to 0.2% of the city budget. And we're thinking of that's the cap. Mm-hmm. And it never approached that, but that was a cap. The current, and then I'm talking general fund for the city of Portland. General fund for city of Portland this year is about $600 million. So 0.2% of that would be $1.2 million. We are figuring $1 million per year, about 10% of that going for administrative costs, and which would mean for every two-year cycle, there would be about $1.8 million available. And we're trying to build our models using that as sort of a cap on how much we would want to expend in the system. And we believe that the 250 cap, the 6-to-1 match, up to $50, using historical data about participation in the city of Portland, would stay within those parameters.
So they do have some historical data in Portland because of the previous system. When you do your modeling, you do some kind of prediction on use. Is that based on how it's been used?
We can do that.
A variety of models have been used in other places? Or?
We can do that. Tam's on the phone. If she can hear us, Tam, can you speak to that? It's her model.
Tam?
Yes, we did try to do that. It's always hard to predict participation, but we tried to estimate it.
And that, the previous system was a grant, and this is a small donor match. So the numbers are going to come out differently, but it does help to figure out how many more people are invited into races by public financing. That sort of thing was predicted by that.
I asked the question because as I've looked at various things, and it's so much per representative, if I just take those and, you know, add it up to 60 every 2 years and two candidates in every race and maybe three at some of them, the numbers get big really fast, and the numbers you're talking about are not at that level. So I'm assuming there's a whittling effect of some kind that you're relying on.
Well, it's true that there is a whittling effect, but if I remember right, with the Portland system, you have to like have an opponent to qualify to have public financing. You obviously have to be up that year to run for office. So if, you know, if we're adapting this for a legislative model, it's not necessarily that every candidate would need to take advantage of the system, right?
The biggest difference would be that in the city of Portland, we have nonpartisan races that can be determined in the primary. So if a candidate receives more than 50% of the vote in the primary, that's the end of the race. So there's no allocation needed for November. It's only if all candidates are below 50% that there's a November election. So just using this year as an example, Commissioner Fritz was reelected in the primary, and Commissioner Novick was kept under 50% and has a runoff. So under this system, the one race would have been settled in March, but there would have been two candidates who would have qualified to use it if they chose to. In November.
And I think what's also really intriguing about the system is that a grant, you know, under the grant system of yesteryear, you just qualify and then you get this huge amount of money and you can spend it as you will. While a match system encourages you to keep campaigning throughout the process and keep reaching out to individuals and keep engaging with your constituents, which a lot of legislators, of course, do on their own. But it's always good to provide additional incentive as opposed to like a match or the grant system.
Yeah, what we're proposing at the initial qualification level of 250 donations of $2,500, we're only allocating up, you know, at a maximum of $15,000. And it's only the candidates that ability to continue raising funds throughout the campaign that will possibly reach that cap of $250,000 in a primary.
Yeah, just kind of curious about some of the numbers because I'm not familiar with the races up there. So in a competitive primary, say for mayor, what do they normally spend in, you know, for a competitive primary and, you know, in so for like Novick's race, what, you know, what's the average that is spent or kind of the median maybe? And then also for the generals in both of those.
Yeah, because there's so few races and there's so many individual factors, it's really hard to quantify that because if an incumbent runs, often there aren't serious and well-funded opponents. Amanda Fritz was reelected in May, and she spent about $24,000. Treasurer Wheeler was elected mayor, and he spent about $900,000. So when you take $24,000 and $900,000, and there's only three races total, it's really hard to look at and say there's a number that, you know, is usable. The last mayor's election 4 years ago, there were three serious candidates who all raised and spent over $1 million.
I guess the question that I would have, like, so, and that was in the primary process prior to like advancing to the general, right?
Well, the one who didn't make it through spent over $1 million just in the primary. The two that made it to November spent $1 million between the primary and the general.
Between the primary and
total,
the general,
right?
Total. Okay. I think I was just kind of curious if you're basing your like your budget and these numbers more on, you know, what you want to allocate in terms of the fiscal, or are you basing it more on, you know, in terms of making it, you know, if I'm a candidate running and I have, like, if I'm Treasurer Wheeler and I spent, you know, $900,000 in the primary, I'm not using your system. Right. It's a waste of my time. Like, right. You know, I mean, I'm not speaking for him. That's probably poorly worded. But you're making a strategic decision on where are you going to be more competitive. And if you think you have resources for $900,000 versus using a private model, I think that's kind of, you know, is this, so it seems to me is almost like it's more based on budgetary rather than kind of,
we're trying to find that happy medium, and we're not sure we found it, but we're trying to find that happy medium where candidates have enough to run a citywide race to reach 350,000 or whatever the number is, voters in the city of Portland, but to also try to control the cost of elections. And so a candidate like Ted Wheeler may decide it doesn't make sense for me to use this system. But his opponent might have said, well, it's going to make me more competitive than I would otherwise be. I'm going to use the system. And it might have been a different race if the other candidates in the race had had this system in place to be able to use it. So we're trying to have it high enough that it will encourage people to use it, but low enough to both protect the public dollars and hopefully bring the cost of elections down. In 2006, when Amanda Fritz ran against incumbent Dan Saltzman, he voluntarily said, I will spend no more than the cap, even though I'm not going to use the system. And he also limited how much he would accept from any one donor below what he had historically done in an election. So in our experience, it changed even the behavior of non-participating candidates in the three elections that happened under the system.
Yeah. Every Voice has been helping Portland kind of run some of the numbers, and it felt like the caps were more based on the desire to use this public financing system as a vehicle to encourage elections to cost less, and then to make sure that we were under, kind of under $1 million. The way we did that was more what's the match rate and what is the number up to which we match, because that can determine to what percent of private dollars are funding the campaigns versus public dollars, but still keeping it under a certain number, so it really is truly small donors. So I don't think that we sacrificed viability to keep the numbers down. I think that what kept the thing that's driving the caps of being a little low is the history and desire in Portland to try and use this to stem the tide of these rising costs of elections. And that it doesn't have to be a component of a public financing system, but in Portland they want it to be.
And we actually started with much lower numbers and raised them to these as we got feedback saying, candidates for mayor just won't use the system if that's how low they are. So we're still concerned that $380,000 might not be enough to get people to participate, everybody to participate. But on the other hand, you can get your message out to voters for $380,000 in the city of Portland. So you at least can be competitive with that amount, even if another candidate is spending $900,000.
And we've noticed that in Portland, there's sort of almost a number that if you have this much money, you can win. And the people who outspend them don't necessarily, that extra money didn't necessarily turn the election in their favor. So I think a lot of what those numbers were set at had to do with what does it take to win, even if you're being outspent.
Right. My only experience is on the legislative side where you competitive legislative races, which are much smaller than Portland, will spend $500,000 to $600,000. So.
I want to follow up on Representative Rayfield's question and get from you. I'm struggling with the thought the how you reduce the cost of races. I'm struggling with Portlandia, but I don't care, so I'm not even going to address the issue of $400,000 for a race. But let me give you a real example. A mailer in a House or Senate district, if you have, pick one, a profit-greedy Republican or a profit-greedy Democrat consultant wants 75 cents, or IPO, we'll be fair here, okay? But whoever the consultant is, it costs about 75 cents to mail a piece of mail. I have 42,000 households that are active voters. That's includes, I got everybody. I got every party, I got some households with six voters, and I got one from every party and a few spares, okay? So it doesn't matter. So I have to mail 42,000 households. That's $30,000 on average just to mail one piece of mail to each household in my district. I mean, as the representative pointed out, competitive races get real expensive. So, Postal Service has screwed the entire rural mail system up, so we're down to the point of, you can mail 25 pieces of mail, but that doesn't matter, okay, because it all arrives on Monday. Third-class mail arrives on Monday every week. If somebody's sales hits me with 12 hit pieces, they're all arriving on Monday. It doesn't matter, okay? It's just the way the system is. So, in theory, the minimum amount just to reach out and educate and communicate to voters in my district is $90,000. That's if I don't have a consultant. I just hire the one person, 75 cents a piece of mail. So that's $90,000. Now, I realize in Portland, there's different mechanisms, and I have five media districts, so that isn't going to work in my district. So I'm just trying to figure out how it is we're going to reduce the cost of campaigning and keep voters informed. Because I think Representative's right, and I'm actually in a pretty good district, because there's districts that got, Senate districts that got 60,000 households. So how do we reduce the cost?
You're asking me?
Yes, because that's so, part of your entire premise here.
So no, actually our premise is just getting it funded by small donors and public funds. We want the public financing system to be so, I won't say so generous, you know, that people are willing to use it, opt into it, even if they expect to have a very competitive race. What we do is we like that number to, is if elections go up in cost, that number that people are able to raise using the public financing system also goes along with it. If it goes down in cost, we like to bring it down with it. But at Every Voice, while we think that reducing the cost of elections is a very noble goal, our number one priority is just making sure that people want to choose the public financing system over the status quo. So we don't work that goal into our stuff. In Portland, the legislators and the community seemed to care very much about that goal. So what we did was we tried to help work the numbers with them so that we could ensure the system was adequate to help people win elections while the local people use their judgment about mechanisms to reduce the cost of elections.
I think we've had, and as with this list here, there's much overlap with our sort of ultimate goals for reform as we've had them. But I think we've identified several times when they work against each other, or it's just difficult. And I think no one assumes every one of these things is going to achieve every piece. But anyway.
But just a quick note: the last time we had public financing in Portland, the cost of elections were higher before it was implemented. The cost went down as a result. Then when it was repealed, cost went back up again. Mm-hmm. So just having
and
the
by
system,
cost, do you mean the expenditures?
The expenditure, yeah, the expenditures.
Whether cost that is sort of an economist question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
So
yeah.
There was an observed reduction just by having the system in place and no other measures.
It seemed to be a shame effect. People were ashamed to be outside the system and outspending the publicly financed candidate. So it just, that seems to be what did it in Portland.
I have a question directed for Every Voice. I'd like to hear your advice about how to write the qualifications to qualify for public finance, because I'm concerned that if these are written by the Democrats and Republicans, they would find a way to effectively exclude the third-party candidates who are genuinely serious candidates but would find it difficult to jump through all the required hoops to qualify for the system.
I see. All we do is try to help legislators identify what is too high a threshold that will be a barrier to people entering the public financing system, even serious candidates, and what is too low that opens the floodgates to candidates that aren't going to run a serious election, aren't going to get more than 2% of the vote, you know, even if they're on a major party ticket, you know, and that the funds that would be given to them would be considered kind of wasteful. So then we look at what like similar populations do. So, you know, Connecticut has qualifying thresholds. They have a lot of third-party participation. And we look at, well, how many, you know, donations do they have to get there compared to their active voting population, you know, and then we compare it to a different jurisdiction. Would this be higher or lower? But often jurisdictions have their own mechanisms. So, like, now, you know, in Oregon, of course, it seems like most people just pay to qualify for the ballot rather than collecting signatures. But in places that do collect signatures, you can kind of say, okay, if they can and have to collect this number of signatures, it's a little harder to get actual donations and not just a signature. So we can kind of base the numbers on each other. So we just give advice on how to set it not too high, not too low. I think it's probably hard to manipulate it to exclude third-party candidates. I think it's what's, you know, although I will say that, yes, like, often if you are a third-party candidate, there are fewer people who identify as being a member of that party, so it can be harder to get people to sign or offer a donation. But we try to have a range that's not too high, not too low, so that it shouldn't exclude the third party. What it should be excluding is really just people who aren't serious at all. But it ultimately is up to the legislators to exercise their judgment about how close to the top range or the bottom range they want to make it.
Can I answer his question a little bit also? The last time we had public financing in Portland, there were a number of candidates who were really like grassroots, not participating in the major parties, and they had to get 1,000 donations. This one requires 250. And I note that a large number of them were able to collect 500, 600. They had a hard time getting to 1,000, but they had no problem exceeding 250. So I think the 250 level would be very easy for a viable third-party candidate to reach.
It doesn't have to be qualifying donations. It can be signatures. It can be just any measure that kind of shows that someone is serious about running a campaign. So we're happy to help advise on whichever measure they want to use for a qualifying threshold.
I actually have a question to Seth because he seems to have the data. And short of a revolution, right? And we're in one, by the way. But short of that, the problem if you don't address both ends of the spectrum at the same time, doesn't the incumbent have the advantage? In Portland, what happened? Did the incumbents all got reelected? Even though we gave Kyle some trinkets over here and let him run, he didn't win, right? Because the incumbent has the advantage. So my only concern is that whatever we do, if we decide to do anything, 6 to 7 votes or whatever, doesn't the incumbent have the advantage? And I don't know what happened because I don't follow Portland. No disrespect, but didn't the incumbents all just basically get reelected? Even though first they got reelected after the first go around, and then when the campaign finance the went away, they still got reelected. Am I correct? Am I missing something? Or is that true or false?
So I haven't analyzed that specific question. I just remember from my memory.
Okay.
I know Sam Adams did do public financing one.
There were only three candidates who did.
He says no, he's three.
So, sorry, from my recollection, there are three candidates who ran under a public financing system in voter-owned elections. I think it was Eric Sten. I think it was, of course, Commissioner Fritz. And then one more who's...
Hornet?
Did Show Desano run under it?
So, there were several different people that used it. Eric Sten was an incumbent and architect of the system, and he chose to use it. And was successful in winning re-election using the system, and then 2 years later he moved on to other things, but Commissioner Fritz was the only one that was successful to use it. But like I said, 4 people also qualified the same for that open seat the same time she did, and then in the mayor's race that year, a candidate intended to use it, but was disqualified because of. A poll that was done before, and it basically became a contribution to his campaign larger than was allowed under the system, and so he was disqualified from using it.
Was that Show DeZono?
Show DeZono.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Jesse Cornett used it, as well as there was a special election when Nick Fish was elected, and I believe his opponent also used it. But only one has been elected. You're right. I don't think there's a system that's been proposed that fixes incumbency and the power of incumbency.
That's right.
And I don't know that we can find it. But for open seats and for people to at least be able to get their message out and raise funds, I mean, people probably realize that large donors generally don't like to go against incumbents because it may cost them down the road. And so it's hard for an opponent to raise funds from large donors. To be able to go to the community and raise $50 from a supporter is much easier to do for an opponent. It's a statistic I was just thinking about the other day. If you get three people to give you $50 on a 6-to-1 match, you've now got the same as somebody giving $1,000. And it's so much easier to go ask three people for $50 than it is to ask one person for $1,000. And so I think it really does provide the at least the opportunity to get the message out, whether the message is evil incumbent or I could do better or, you know, whatever it is, it allows that message to get out much more than under the current system where people don't want to fund non-incumbents.
Yeah. There are public financing systems that do significantly reduce the power of incumbency. They do tend to be passed on the ballot. So they can address that problem, but they don't, by definition, in any way reinforce the power of incumbency. They usually can either reduce the power of it or keep it the same. But there's just certain aspects of being an incumbent that do give you the ability to raise usually large donations more easily than a challenger.
It's a good question that you brought up, because that was one of the reasons why I wanted to make sure that the in-kind issues were resolved, because one of the main ways that an incumbent gets support is because they're an incumbent. They get a huge amount of in-kind support, and that could potentially be something that helps an incumbent versus someone else. So those are the kinds of things we do need to look out for.
Anybody on the phone have questions of these folks? Turn off your mute. Well, please holler if there is. Anybody who hasn't asked a question or is still feeling? Norman?
Well, I just wanted to comment and reinforce Senator Boquist's question, and that's a very important aspect of this. I don't think our goal is really to reduce the cost of elections. In fact, if you reduce the cost of elections too much, you do tend to protect incumbents because the voters don't know the challengers. So our goal should be to provide sufficient funds so that the voters actually have the knowledge in order to make a good choice. And that usually argues for somewhat higher spending limits in the process. We want to make sure that voters are educated, in other words.
Well, I want to thank the folks for being here and give them. Oh, go ahead, Nikki.
I was wondering, under the previous Portland system, if it increased diversity among candidates who participated in the program, and then how this program will do outreach to make sure that it diversifies the participants of who are running.
Anecdotally, Commissioner Fritz was elected. She was only the seventh woman in the history of Portland to be elected, so a little bit of diversity there. There was an African-American candidate who ran in her race as well, was able to get the funds and run a good campaign. We are working with the communities of color and others in Portland to try to ascertain that this will work for their constituencies. And so we've had meetings, we've gone to their board meetings and others. Do you want to add anything?
Yeah, so Commissioner Fritz actually at a couple of public forums also made the recommendation that she and perhaps other elected officials would be able to start sort of like a candidate school for these specific communities, and working, of course, with the community organizations who already do that work. But she would be able to sort of lead people to be able to, you know, figure out, you know, how does one run? How would someone actually use this system? So sort of like a candidate school, that sort of thing. We're still working out the details.
And we find that while public financing certainly enables more diverse candidates to run and win, without a candidate pipeline of some kind, often that diversity doesn't get actualized. And so we strongly encourage, well, in fact, we don't just help pass things. When they're passed, we help make sure they're implemented, both by the government, but we also help advocacy organizations organize around them, and we highly recommend that people, organizations, really take seriously their role at identifying potential candidates to run using public financing and pressuring incumbents to actually use public financing and not just use their current donor base.
Go ahead.
A quick comment as well. I don't necessarily see public financing's goal as to be anti-incumbent. I see it as being a way for an incumbent maybe to be able to reach out to the community, possibly consciously or subconsciously, maybe adopt more closely the policies of their constituents. And so I think the number of incumbents that don't get reelected to me is not a measure necessarily of the quality of the program. I'd rather focus on the quality of the program and goals behind it rather than whether or not more incumbents win or lose.
Yeah, I think just kind of echoing that, I think one real value of this program is that, and public financing in general, is that candidates can run for office, run a competitive campaign, and can win by raising money only from, you know, people in their own district. And in Oregon, we can't ban people from raising money outside of their district because the courts have ruled on that. But what public financing does is it amplifies the voices of people in your district, so it refocuses where you're raising money from, away from raising money from folks, you know, outside of Oregon or in other parts of the state, and make sure that candidates are spending time raising money from people in their own district. I think that's really, really valuable to make sure that people, the everyday voters, feel that they're being fully represented, kind of regardless of what the political stripe is. And I think allowing candidates the ability to run competitive campaigns and to win by making that choice to only raise money from small donations from people in our district, I think that itself is a really strong value, too.
Madam Secretary.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator.
Back to the discussion Seth and I had, which applies all the way across the board, is if you look at all the anger that's out there, and the reason we're all sitting here, the reason we're in the task force, it's the entire system, not just one little piece. And my point exactly to what Nikki's saying here is that it's if you run and win in a seat, and I don't know the answer to this, but I do know that the commissioners are all paid because we only have one of the only board commission, whatever, one of the only two or three city governments is like your guys's, right? And so if you're a minority, you know, if you're a Hispanic woman and run and you use this system and win, you still can, and you're a single Hispanic woman as an example, you can still take care of your kids and be a commissioner, right? It's not just about running here. The problem we face here, I mean, just legislature, I don't know about Representative Rayfield, but I know he does the same thing I do. He looks at his finance sheet every week and figures out how he's going to pay the rent or the mortgage, because if you're going to be a legislator, you're going to spend an awful lot of time here. And the fact of the matter is, in this legislature, the only thing you're going to get, no disrespect here, is someone who is either has resources. They're either independently wealthy, they either have a steady income, or they're a retiree. That's what you're going to get in the legislature, no matter what you do in the campaign finance system, because you cannot live on $1,800 a month, pay your bills, and do everything else like that. And we face the same problems in some of our other areas that we're talking about campaign finance reform in here, in which, you know, I hate to tell you, if you're the mayor of Bend, who I don't think is paid, by the way, for sure of that, I don't know though, mayor of Bend, you're going to spend an inordinate amount of time during the week, Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, when you're supposed to be working. And so when we want to overhaul the system of campaign finance, it's both ends of the spectrum. Because if you don't know, go to Orstar. We have candidates that have been elected in the legislature and in other positions that literally are living off their campaign finance account because legal counsel says, other than the bed I can't buy, I can virtually spend my campaign finance account on anything else, my mileage back and forth, so on and so forth. So it's kind of a process. If we want to get more diversification and we really want to represent the public, which was what we need to do, regardless of whether you're a Democrat or Republican or independent, is when we put this package together, we have to have some side recommendations, a sideboard, that this is only going to work if you do also X, Y, Z. Because even I, who's considered to be this, you know, right-wing extremist rich person, have a hard time paying my bills every month, okay?
I'd like to let our guests go and move to a discussion with the group to prep us for the next meeting. So do you have closing?
I just want to make one last comment. We're doing it at the city of Portland because we believe we have the political support to do it. It's not the ideal place for this to be at the first place, because it is a highly desirable position that requires actually running part of the city, the commission form of government. And so it's really not a beginner's job. It's not a job that somebody who has no political experience really is suited for. And so it's not ideal in that regard. I think the legislature is a much better place to get a diverse array of candidates that connect closer to their community, that have smaller constituencies. And so I would actually like to encourage you to really strongly consider adopting a system that would go beyond the borders of the city of Portland, that will help diversify the legislature and hopefully elected officials throughout this, at every level throughout the state.
that message. Appreciate it. Thank you all for being willing to come and, as I say, to lay out some politics that I think people might not have been willing to do.
And I'll leave a stack of business cards over there so that anyone who has any questions can reach out to me.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
Very good.
I'd like to second the motion by the senator to increase his own salary.
No, I've learned from the process. I'm going to make a proposal to limit my salary. And then people will vote yes.
I do think as we go from here to our next meeting, it will be good for us to revisit, and I will bring back and remind the sort of general principles. We didn't have outcome goals so much as making sure that we met certain things, not all of which, I mean, we've added to them, or some of the discussion is added to them, and the more goals we try to meet, the harder it's going to be to land on something that isn't going to either miss or be contradictory. So I would hope that we might have some focus about this. I do hope, and had a thought before this meeting, to do a little outreach, at least to the rest of the legislature. You all might have suggestions for others. As we approach the next topic, which is really our current system for enforcing campaign laws, including reporting, but not exclusively reporting, at least in my mind, that I would like to reach out and try to see if we can get before us suggestions that legislators may already be thinking about, and that will, I think, help us know what we maybe need to react to or have some positions about. I also think it would be helpful, having listened to this discussion and understanding the concern that people don't want to spend a lot of time investment on something that wouldn't necessarily have that bigger majority support than we had for our original recommendation, and would offer to work on and I don't know, a limited number of possible resolutions that we could sort of test ourselves about. The more general ones will be a little easier, but it would allow us to see if there is no interest or only a minority interest in exploring recommendations, even if they're not so granular as to be, you know, legislatively drawn, but that the legislature look at a public finance system, either being expansion of the tax credit, which is another thing that we learned something about, or through grants or matching programs to get a clear sense of whether or not folks want to, where the group is with respect to pursuing a recommendation around that. There was at least one member of the task force at one point for whom expansion to using other people's resources, which tax credits do, which public funding does, to support candidates had a philosophical problem. If that's going to be a barrier for, you know, any of the organizations that are represented here or individuals, let's find that out and see whether or not we still maintain a quorum level, if I don't know what to call more than a bare majority, but, you know, less than unanimity, that could help us move ourselves forward. And I'd offer to work with Trustee Aaron and others to perhaps try to articulate what perhaps would be good questions for people to be prepared to kind of land on in that regard, and would seek from you either at this moment or as we. As we move forward, have a number of issues that I think have been raised over time. Excuse me, I'm not finding the piece of paper I'm looking for. As possible topics to discuss in with respect to our current system. And now I've lost it, and I'm sorry. issues around reporting and enforcement that I would like to have people available to talk about, maybe the current system, and obviously that would be probably people within my team, but also for your consideration, and I'll try to get those out to you in advance, and I would appreciate people adding to that. One whole category of things that was talked about early and haven't come back to is efforts to make the data easier to access and understand. If people do look at OurStar, people don't look at OurStar. Why do they? Why do they not? Are there ways that could make it better to understand, so the public had a wider understanding, or the things that reports or a variety of things that could make it people give them a more accurate picture of how money's being used. We've had the issue of nonprofits and PACs that are perhaps set up quickly, and understanding the donors behind that, and what is our current situation with respect to that? What are some of the pitfalls or questions if indeed we're going to, eventually maybe come to some recommendation around more visibility around those donors? We've talked about whether penalties should be increased. The reporting penalties are fairly, minimal, particularly if you correct them fast. They only tend to get big if it happened to be a large amount of money and that was misreported and it goes for a long time. That's when the penalties get up there. Prohibitions on coordination. We identified the fact that while reporting it incorrectly is a reporting violation, therefore it's only subject to the correction and then potential penalty, which might be relatively small if it's done quickly, might be bigger if it takes longer, and concern that's the case. One of the things I think we have to throw out there is the potential of making coordination itself a violation if under certain circumstances, if we feel like that's a problem. I'm not saying we do, but I think that's an area that we've had. We've talked a little bit about auditing. You have, I think, a very profound reaction from the staff of the Elections Division that in the days where they were required to keep on due annual audits of every PAC, they had notebooks and notebooks and notebooks of data that nobody ever looked at and felt very much and that this was, it was not a useful, did not generally come up with anything except the kinds of reporting problems that might have identified anyway. Major issues weren't necessarily identified. A lot of was invested, and that's why the legislature repealed that. But it has come up several times. Perhaps there are other ways to go about auditing, more targeted auditing. I suggest that that's going to create its own challenges for people to think about, but don't want to think that it's gone away. And another area that comes up quite often in our world, I don't know that it's been brought up at this table. I think I may have at least one, but that I would like to explore a little bit is our investigative timelines. We have the ability to request people give us information. We have no deadlines by which we can keep them to do that. On the criminal side, if it would be a criminal violation, and there are a few of them in our electoral staff, that goes to the Department of Justice, and they have some power and authority to do something about it. But if we have just inquiry about uncertainty about or a complaint is filed and we're trying to investigate that, and it's on the civil side, having some deadlines is something that I think might be worth considering to make the system work a little better. Those are both small and big issues, and I welcome from you for our next agenda other issues that you think we might have already come up with. And if you're brain dead today, please pass them in the next week or two, and we'll try to get them to you, get them on the agenda. Dave?
I just have a question for Representative Rayfield. He mentioned earlier he's working or exploring public financing options. Mm-hmm. And so the question, I think you hinted that you might be able to report to the task force at the September meeting.
Putting
And probably not necessarily on the public financing thing at this point. Probably going to hold off until we, you know, I have something a little bit more concrete. Okay. And so, because a lot of the same issues that, quite frankly, the city of Portland is looking at. You know, we've, you know, met with a lot of the different folks trying to nail down some of those ideas. And so that probably will be a little bit later when everything's nailed down. I mean, I will be running the other bill that actually passed through the Rules Committee and went to the Ways and Means, which actually does have an auditing component, not spot checking. And I think there's a real difference between spot checking. It's like, you know, I always make this distinction. If we're filing a tax return and you're spot checking, you're checking what has been filed, not the actual supporting documents. So the problem with the spot checking is we're checking people that are complying and actually filing. Oh, I filed $100. Here's the $100. We're not checking for the absence of something. So, for instance, you wouldn't run the IRS or federal tax system without having auditors. That'd be foolish. And so what auditing, true auditing, would actually do is actually look at the absence of filing, where you would go and actually look, pull somebody's bank account and make sure it matches up. Because right now, I could blow in $10,000 into my account, spend $10,000, and nobody would be none the wiser, and there's nothing really you could do about it. And so that would encourage more compliance with things like that, where I would totally agree if I say I filed $1,000 of various transactions, of course I did, or else I wouldn't have put it in the system. I might have made some minor errors along the way. But so that bill and some of the increased penalties and stuff is something that, you know, we're definitely doing. We're kind of, there's a couple of other issues that we're actually tweaking and refining to add some stuff, but we're going to run that bill again for sure.
So I think the elements, yeah, at least, and the issues involved in his bill will be something that will be on our list next time. And
but at this
for the
point,
to
are
react
you
to.
Contemplating actually have something related to public financing for the next session?
Yes.
Beth has a question.
Yeah.
So a good discussion. That is one of the good reasons for having an early reaction to whether or not the group generally would support an effort to do that, and with whatever sidebars you want to say, and how, you know, what does a good majority of the group feel about that is good information to go forward. Seth had a question in Norman.
On that subject, I know that a lot of not very high resource campaigns have a hard time doing like responding to audits and things like that. Have you thought about lowering the penalties if somebody were to, say, give the state their bank account through, there's all this like Quicken style access,
yeah,
so they could actually synchronize OrStar directly and have an automated system where it's more automatic, and therefore would be a lot easier to handle the filing period.
Yeah, the we'd have to, obviously, you know, the Secretary of State would know, is there would be, you know, modernization with our technology to allow that to happen, which would, you know, have its own fiscal. But I think moving in that direction is probably inevitable at some point, right?
Okay.
Where if it did match like that Quicken type style, or the where it downloads the transactions and then you just classify them,
yeah,
and kind of
purpose and classification, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that would be, you know, that would simplify the entire process, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Oh.
Good thoughts. I'm sorry, Norman.
People use do Quicken and stuff like that.
Madam Secretary, I wanted to say I'm actually rather optimistic that we have an opportunity here to make some progress on campaign finance reform. The whole political environment seems to have shifted in the last year or two. You know, we've even got Donald Trump complaining about super PACs in his campaign, and other national candidates have come out in favor of campaign finance reform in general, and even public financing. So that on the state level, we really do, I think, have a good opportunity, and that's also shown in the polls that we saw earlier. My concern is that since we're meeting monthly, we're not going to be able to make progress rapidly enough to have an impact and be ready for the legislative session that's coming up. And if we don't do work between our meetings, perhaps in subcommittees, we won't be making progress rapidly enough. So I'd like us to discuss, if possible, before the end of this meeting, exactly how we can make progress and what the timeline for different components of our consideration would be, so that we can make that kind of progress and have be ready for the next session. I myself won't even be able to come to the October meeting, but I'm sure you'll get along without me. But that probably will be a crucial meeting for consideration of what we go to the legislature with. So if I could request a discussion on what our process is between meetings and how we can accomplish what we want to get done, that would be helpful.
So part of this comes back to the question that I think Rob brought up to begin with, and depends on how granular the group wants to be. If this group wants to be in the design of legislative drafts business, I think that's true. We could meet weekly or have subcommittees that worked on things, but we do want it to be, of course, we would want it to be only on things that we know we have a substantial amount of support for to make that worthwhile. I think what we discovered, in my view, and I can be overridden or at least forced to reconsider, in the last go around, is that legislators are going to be working on this stuff and aren't necessarily waiting to get recommendations from us. We have the opportunity to influence, however, and endorse or object or provide feedback about what might be missing from those things as they come along. I think that would be a given the divisions that we have among ourselves, that may be a more useful function than trying to actually design legislative ideas. I do have vehicles, and so if there are things that people feel strongly about and you get to January and know that somebody, nobody's going to be doing this and it's something that needs to be done, and I'm certainly willing to take up the notion of subcommittees, I think, after the September meeting, but I would like to see whether there is enough interest in remedial changes in our current system and reaction to the public financing piece before we decide. If you do decide, it's more important that we draft something that takes all of our concerns into consideration than it is to have resolutions and recommendations that we offer to the legislature as they are having their consideration. So, Representative Kahneman.
I was just sitting here with Representative Rayfield, and he and I sit on the House Rules Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And if this group comes up with a concept, it's likely that we could move forward through that process as well. So that gives us.
The first session was not the place, obviously, but this would certainly be much.
And just for a point of clarification, I mean, and the two representatives can chime in here, I mean. And even you, Madam Secretary, have some leverage in bill drafting for the legislature. Doesn't mean we're going to consider it, but just. But I think we're talking February or March before even bill drafts are cut off traditionally. So, even though we got these, you hear the newspaper selling newspapers like, you know, this and that, and so on and so forth. And we have some bloody deadline in September too. But it really is meaningless. I mean, we can go clear into January meetings and make a proposal and get it drafted and. Assuming I get reelected as the incumbent and I raise the money. I have in the past beat the president up and got bills, and we can. So I don't think, Norm, it's do or die in the next 6 weeks. I think there's plenty of time to put legislation forward.
But I do think
where there's a will, there's a way in the legislature. But getting things onto the table and in the way is often as important as having the will to get go forward.
I do think what we can arrive at in the next 4 weeks to 6 weeks is whether or not the recommendations this group is able to form a consensus, coalesce around, and again, not requiring unanimity, around topics that we believe the legislature should take up and then make a decision about, and is it so important that it be drafted this way, and this way, that it has to include certain things to be, to maintain the majority support for it, that we should then, you know, do some work in between to begin that drafting or at least outlining process to inform that. Those decisions.
Madam Secretary, if I could just jump in, I want to support what you just said because I think those policy directions are going to be a lot more important to have at the outset, whereas I think Aaron can probably attest that the technical details of these bills tend to get worked out later in the process anyway, even though you want to have some place to start from. But so frequently, they're placeholders, and they change a great deal. And so I think knowing, you know, where the consensus is, and I think that it's likely to come up, given that this task force has existed for quite a while now, people are going to say, well, where was the task force on that issue? And I think that would be a lot more valuable. And the other can continue, you know, on the technical side, it doesn't need to be done right now.
Rob?
Thank you, Madam Secretary. I agree, I think, with where the direction of the conversation is that I think it's more important to say in the short term that we're focused on maybe a statement like any campaign finance reform needs to consist of a various measures, including maybe but not limited to the following, which we generally support, and we could put some form of public financing. I would not oppose some sort of a cap on contributions that would require a constitutional amendment, some sort of tagline requirement that could require a constitutional amendment. We don't have to talk about the specific amendment. We could talk about the goals and policies, and that each of these should be considered. I would definitely throw in actually increasing the salaries of both statewide and legislative candidates, because that impacts campaign finance if it's necessary for candidates to look at the campaign money they raise for their basic expenses. So I think that does implicate reform on campaign finance. We don't need to get bogged down in the details. Those are going to be worked out in this building, not by us. But I think if we get a general direction and say, look, real finance, real reform in this area is going to take a bundle of ideas. There's no magic bullet here. Just like our experts have testified to, each of these should review. I would even throw in instant runoff voting like the Benton County. That's going way afield. I know, and I've mentioned that before, but I'm just saying it could. We should focus on maybe more of a mission statement sort of thing with a bundle of things that we urge the legislature to consider, and we have general consensus that these are valuable. Some of them may be more valuable or doable than others. But I think if we keep it in general and get it out there, sooner the better, so we can the powers that be start working on it, would be one route to go.
I want to agree. I think we should take a top-down approach to this and sort of maybe have a straw vote at the beginning of next session that here are the topics that we want to consider and maybe flesh out a little detail out of them. But if we get too far down into the weeds, we'll not be successful in pushing forward our ideas.
And I think there's a lot of value in terms of not only considering things that are already possibly moving forward, although, of course, I'm sure the legislator is interested to know where a task force feels about bills that have a chance of moving forward and are already drafted, for instance. But I think one value of this task force is bringing together stakeholders who have an expertise in this policy or in campaign finance to consider options on the table. And, you know, for instance, if there's a policy that might not have a bill draft at this point, but something that we could get stakeholders to offer input on, like, for instance, the People's Pledge, or, you know, like, for instance, possibly like a disclaimer bill. I think that's valuable because I think it's really great to have a chance to bring forward stakeholders to consider options on legislation and policies
when it's hard to get people in the room to think about that ordinarily. So I think there's a value about expanding it beyond just what's what is already being pursued to also think about other policy ideas too.
I did in one meeting with one person in legislative leadership, and I will pledge to do it around to all of them, ask them if they would encourage their members, even if they are just, you know, considering the possibility of something within, to come and let the group say, here are the 10 questions we've asked about that kind of thing, or we've heard about. I do think offering expertise is going to be a very useful thing. So we have a little bit of a shape here to sort of have some maybe big ticket straw pulling. I would like to explore some of these, what might be called smaller or more reform than revolution in our current system, to see if any of those are big enough to be described and be part of a menu that you think is important to put forward. So I would like to spend a little bit of time on that, maybe, and then maybe we get to our straw polling. But am open to suggestion. And we're going to have minority viewpoint, no matter what. You know, based on principle, based on good analysis of people's experience, and we're going to need to acknowledge that all the way around. But I think what leadership and I think these legislators would appreciate is something that doesn't look like a split vote, but is a little bit more fulsome in terms of encouragement of where to go forward. Appreciate your patience with it. It's a tough subject. Thank you, Dave.
Madam Secretary, mm-hmm. I just have one very minor technical question. Uh-huh. Given the concepts or ideas that you proposed earlier, mm-hmm. Instead of monitoring, reporting, and so on, I'm curious, how many staff do you actually have in the elections division?
How many staff in the elections division? So I think of 35, 18.
What was the question?
I was just looking at we can get you that answer, but it's in the 20, you know, max 20 altogether. Right.
And Madam Secretary, I would just second, you know, maybe at the next meeting or laundry listing or whatever, so members understand, I mean, the topic of election law enforcement is what you're really talking about.
Yes.
And if you don't know, the Secretary of State doesn't have any power. Representative Rayfield's just example, he pointed out, is bank statements. She can ask all day long for them to send them the bank statements for her, and they can just hit delete key every time she sends it. And it doesn't matter until it ends up in a criminal side and they do a deal. And so there's even the notion of electronic. Boy, my wife would love you, Seth. If all she had to do is push the bloody quicken button and it all went to the Secretary of State, she'd vote for you for president.
A little more than
that. At least a great idea.
Yeah, but the problem is for, you know, she will tell you, they have no authority to go out because it's the transaction reporting is what the law is. And so you would think that someone would say, hey, look, I really screwed it up. I'm the new treasurer or something. Here's my bank statements. Help me fix this. They got no options, none whatsoever.
There are people who voluntarily do that, but as you say, that tends to be people looking.
Then they get fined, obviously.
Yeah, $150, right? Cost of doing business.
And there are real examples that go on where the Secretary of State's office asks for documents and the other side says no. That happens. That goes on.
Well, thank you. And the thoughts and ideas, I pulled some of these again from previous discussion and things that go on here, but happy to take more of them from you. Thank you. I'm going to go home and draw a diagram of the City of Portland requirements up against the Multnomah County ones and see how those come out. I did think that was an interesting puzzle. No, I'm not. I'm in Washington County. I don't have to do any of that. Okay, I got to adjourn. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, I got to adjourn.